This is The Takeaway for Monday, May 9th, 2016.
Paul Ryan, I don't know what happened. I don't know.
I'm just not ready to do that at this point. I'm not there right now. And I hope to, though, and I want to.
I think it would be better if it were unified. There would be something good about it.
I think Paul Ryan, his political career is over.
Lindsey Graham, a total dope. Jeb Bush, very low-energy individual, signed a pledge.
You have to draw the conclusion that there is some distance, if not a disconnect.
Does the party have to be together? I actually don't think so.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckaberry. Thanks so much for listening. And look at the hangover in the GOP on this Monday. What was in that Trump vodka? The presumptive Republican nominee is facing a mutiny from conservatives led by Wisconsin's Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House. Who outranks whom right now, Ryan or Trump? Technically, Ryan is the highest ranking Republican in the country. He's third in line in the constitutional order of succession. But what will happen if Trump makes it to the White House? Is Ryan trying to make sure Trump loses in November so he, Ryan, can pick up the pieces? Does that mean the end of the Republican Party? The Speaker of the House will meet with his party's presumptive nominee, who is now saying that he should be the one in charge, that he and his constituency of angry voters are the future.
I have to stay true to my principles also. And I'm a conservative. But don't forget, this is called the Republican Party. It's not called the Conservative Party. You know, there are conservative parties. It's called the Republican Party. I am a conservative.
You get a sense of the kinds of conversations that are going to go on between the Trump and Ryan camps over the next few weeks. Listen to Trump getting some pushback from conservative talk show host Charlie Sykes from Milwaukee a few weeks ago.
I can tell you this, Charlie. I have been better to women than any of these candidates, frankly.
Except you won't apologize to a woman that you mocked.
I have executive people and at a very, very high level. I have executive people that are women. I gave women early chances in construction, numerous women early chances in construction when nobody else was doing it.
Charlie Sykes, conservative talk show host in Paul Ryan's home state of Wisconsin.
We're not just talking about whether we disagree on this policy or not. You know, we're talking about somebody who's got a penchant for arbitrary and authoritarian government, you know, who's addicted to internet hoaxes, whose relationship with the truth is, shall we say, challenged, you know, the tendency towards race baiting. All of these things, I think, you know, raise fundamental issues. You know, when he launched the campaign, I thought he represents the cartoon image that the left has had of conservatives. And the real challenge was to say, okay, you know what? You've been saying that we are all of these things. The liberals have been saying that conservatives are, you know, misogynist and they're, you know, racially insensitive and all of these sorts of things. And then suddenly you have this cartoon caricature of every one of those images of conservatives. And I do think that it is absolutely crucial for at least some conservatives to stand off in the wilderness, you know, throughout this disaster and say, by the way, that was not us. That was the cartoon version.
Although, are they standing in the wilderness? They're mostly standing on K Street. People like Bill Kristol and these conservative, you know, thinkocrats who have basically hijacked the party and the, face of the party on television. But don't you want access to this huge group of angry people who are willing to vote against Hillary Clinton? I mean, isn't that what Trump represents here, an opportunity?
Well, I like the phrase thinkocrats, by the way. You know, you mentioned K Street. What is interesting to me are the number of the Washington insiders, the actual establishment, who are the first to jump on the Trump train, because they actually recognize that that Donald Trump is somebody they can deal with, a man of no principles, no fixed ideas. And they don't have a problem with this because what they see is their access to power, as opposed to the kinds of ideas that conservatives like Bill Kristol, like Paul Ryan, have been talking about for the last 20 years. I think the K Street lobbyists are going to be more than comfortable with Donald Trump. I think they think of him as malleable and somebody who, frankly, you know, is going to be comfortable in their world of crony capitalism.
So Paul Ryan, he can hold out here? I mean, this is going to go all the way to November?
Well, I don't know. I can't predict that. I think that what Paul Ryan is doing is important. I mean, Paul Ryan has two roles. He, is, of course, is the Speaker of the House of Representatives, leader of the Republicans, and so he has a political responsibility. But he is also the de facto intellectual leader of the Republican Party and of conservatism. Look, I think that a lot of Republicans need to realize that if you embrace Donald Trump, you're embracing the whole package. You are going to spend the next 6 months having to defend or rationalize or evade questions about every single Twitter insult, every single slur, every single false statement, every single outrageous comment by Donald Trump. And I do think it's absolutely important for some conservatives to distance themselves from this. So, you know, when they, after November, when we have to pick up the pieces, they'll be able to say, okay, you know what? I was willing to dissent when it actually mattered. Think about this moment we're at in American political history, where Sarah Palin is setting the standards for rational discourse among conservatives. Get your head around this. Sarah Palin, who is castigating someone like Paul Ryan for daring to ask for a conversation about the visions for the future of the country. Someone's going to have to go back to all of these constituencies who have been insulted, who have been alienated by Donald Trump, and be able to say, all right, here is an alternative vision. I do not know how Republicans who embrace Donald Trump will be able to go back to women, minorities, young people, and say, that wasn't us. Because if you support Donald Trump for president of the United States, that is you. That is who you are.
Charlie Sykes, conservative talk radio host. Always great to talk to you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mercury.
There's a little black spot on the sun today. It's the same old thing as yesterday.
Donald Trump is the GOP's king of political pain right now, but we are more interested in that little black spot on the sun we told you about at the top of the hour. Mercury is transiting in front of the sun, and you can see it with the proper equipment. Later on, we will try and gauge what kind of blot on the global economy corruption makes. It's more of a large black smudge constraining growth and development all over the world. And it turns out the U.S. is a global enabler of tax cheats and money launderers. But all over the country, amateur astronomers are gathering to watch Mercury try and fail to eclipse the sun. Jason Kendall, adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University and member of the Amateur Astronomers Association, was with a gathering of stargazers at the northern reaches of the island of Manhattan on a baseball diamond in Inwood Hill Park. How fast was Mercury traveling?
Oh, wow. Well, it orbits the sun once every 88 days, so it'll pass across, from our perspective, Mercury will pass across the sun in approximately 6 hours or so, and that, I forget exactly the orbital speed, but yet, if you're going to be going around an orbit that's a third of 93 million miles, or 33 times 2 pi, oh my goodness, 33 million times 2 pi, I don't know what that is, divided by 88 days, it's pretty fast.
Pretty fast. Can you see the motion as you watch it cross the sun's path?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We've been already watching that. I have a projection screen as well as a dedicated solar telescope, and we've already seen the change in position of Mercury across the face of the sun. It's moving right across, and it's just totally striking. When you look at it in terms of with a solar telescope, it looks like this really, really sharply defined circle. And there's this big sunspot that's in the middle of the sun right now, so you can really tell the difference between a sunspot and Mercury.
What do you think when you see that little guy just so close to the sun like that, moving past it?
Well, it's just kind of really fun. I mean, when we did the Venus transit back in 2012, it was kind of magical because here it is, this once every really long time event that occurs. And for us up here and for amateur astronomers, this is a lot of fun. But the big thing is that transits like these have important scientific value for like the Kepler Space Telescope, and it's how we find planets around other stars.
Why doesn't it just fall into the sun? It just seems like it just couldn't possibly orbit that way.
Well, that's a really good question. Yeah, actually, Mercury is falling towards the sun. It just has a lateral speed such that if it were to hit the sun, it's already moved to the left. So it's always falling towards the sun, but it's got this lateral speed and moving around the sun at the same time. So there's really two motions, the regular motion that's the lateral velocity around the sun, but then it's always falling towards it in the same way that, so it orbits the sun in the same way the International Space Station orbits the Earth. It's falling towards the Earth. It's just going left at 20,000 miles an hour, so it never hits the ground. I mean, the ground curls away at the same rate as the spaceship falls towards the ground.
Yeah. And that's why Earth is falling towards the sun and doesn't actually hit it. That's what the orbit is. But I tell you, it just seems so perilously close, Mercury.
Well, Mercury is actually not the closest planet we found around other stars. The Kepler Space Telescope has found planets that are super large that orbit their suns in less than a day. And so these might be Jupiter-sized planets, planets as big as Jupiter, that actually spin around their sun really fast, and they're super-duper hot. So Mercury does not hold the record as the hottest planet known.
Is it the case that when we're looking at that dark side of Mercury passing in front of the sun, that we're looking at one of the coldest places in the solar system?
Yes, because Mercury, absolutely, because Mercury has no atmosphere. So the Earth's atmosphere allows us to have this nice blanket that keeps in the warmth of the day. But when we look at Mercury, it doesn't have that. So as soon as you go to the night side, the rocks would cool off almost immediately. So you can imagine on the surface of Mercury, the boundary between day and night, you probably can hear the rocks cracking and popping, just in the same way like when you pour water onto an iron skillet. The entire surface of Mercury has to be cracking and popping like that.
I just can't imagine how it stays together so hot on one side and so cold on the other without just sort of crumbling.
Well, it's a huge ball of rock. And so, and it gets up to about 800 degrees. But to me, the fascinating thing that was discovered at Mercury was that the North and South Poles have really deep craters. And in those craters is water ice. It's been there for billions of years.
Wow.
And this is a really cool discovery. It's just like, it's really cold there. It's one of the coldest places in the solar system at the North and South Pole of Mercury.
Now, don't look at the sun, Jason, directly. Right.
Exactly. That's a big caution. See, some people, when they try to do this, they go, oh, I can just use my sunglasses.
No.
And, you know, they end up in the hospital.
Yeah, and we would advise everyone out there not to look directly at the sun.
Absolutely. Always use a proper filter or a projection screen, which is what I'm using.
Well, Jason, of course, you're well equipped with gadgets and fabulous scopes of various kinds. Jason Kendall is adjunct professor of astronomy at William Patterson University. Have a great time.
Thank you so much.
So what's one event in nature you've traveled for or waited to see?
Hi, this is Mary from Portland, Oregon. The event in nature that I traveled to see was the snake shadow at Chichen Itza in Mexico during the autumnal equinox. It was spectacular.
New York. I traveled with my dad and my two young children to be on the midpoint of a lunar transit solar eclipse a few years ago. We drove about 4.5 hours each way. For me, it was a volcano, Mount St. Helens. 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. Tweet us at The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Audible, provider of audiobooks on topics ranging from astronomy to zombies. More at audible.com/listen. Audible, stories that surround you.
More access to the notorious Panama Papers begins today with a new database allowing searchable access to the names and some information about 200,000 offshore entities. The International Consortium of Investigative Journalists is withholding the actual documents with individuals' personal information. But we already know some 200 Americans are named, some of whom have already been charged with financial crimes. On Friday, President Obama announced new rules that require banks to know the identities of the owners of those mysterious shell companies.
We've seen the degree to which both legal practices of tax avoidance that are still unfair and bad for the economy, as well as illegal practices that in some cases involve nefarious activities continue to exist and to spread.
So who is holding what in the United States, and where are American corporations holding their profits? We turn to Frank Clementi, executive director of the Americans for Tax Fairness.
An enormous amount of money is in these tax havens. There's estimates that it's as little as $7 trillion or as much as $20 trillion. It's offshore in tax havens. Just to give you a little scale, if you taxed $7 trillion at 2%, that would raise about $140 billion. That's as much as all governments give in global aid around the world each year. So we're talking big chunks of money.
And these are countries that could use the money to invest in their own infrastructure, to build things up, to make roads better. And even in the United States, I mean, this capital could be used to improve things in places that are crumbling. You know, I don't even have to point out Flint, Michigan, right?
To give you a sense of the scale, U.S. multinational corporations have $2.4 trillion that's offshore. Most of that money is in tax havens where they're paying nothing back here to America. We figure that that would raise about $700 billion if we brought that money back home. That's enough to double the amount of money that the U.S. government is spending on rebuilding our infrastructure over the next 10 years. We would double the budget we're spending on rebuilding our infrastructure over the next 10 years. So it's a very substantial sum of money that's sitting offshore right now going untaxed.
Anything in the new rules announced by the government? The president mentioned an aggressive effort on the part of the Justice Department to go after people in the Panama Papers. Anything likely to change the situation for people who have had such a comfortable tax haven, comfortable set of assets offshore for so long?
The Treasury rules are certainly going to help. They will help to identify who is behind many of these accounts and corporations that are stashing money in offshore tax havens. We think it does not go far enough, however. Its definition of who is the beneficial owner, that's who's actually owns the money, is not strong enough. So a lot of these holders of these accounts will not go reported. It also doesn't cover existing accounts. It's always going to cover future accounts that get set up. So the millions of accounts that already exist in offshore tax havens, we will not know who the owners are of those accounts.
Is part of the problem here that tax law has not kept pace with the ability of companies to shift it around electronically, and that that's one way in which governments are really not able to legislate ahead of what the multinational corporations want to do?
Oh, I wish it was that simple. I mean, we have here in America, Delaware, which is the tax haven of the world. It is easier to set up a corporation in Delaware than it is to get a library card in most countries. You don't have to disclose who you are, who's behind the corporation, or give reports going forward. So this lets criminals, drug dealers, fraudsters, and people that are trying to dodge taxes go free.
And this means that the U.S. is one of the biggest enablers of corruption around the world through these state tax havens.
Absolutely. And that's part of the problem. There is legislation in Congress that would open the door on this. You know, we're all working very hard to get it passed. But, you know, honestly, the administration is not leading enough on this. It really needs to be out front. And this should be bipartisan legislation. I mean, Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, used to support this legislation. All of a sudden, he's not doing it anymore. It would throw sunshine on this tax haven process.
If the U.S. is preferring Switzerland and places in Asia to, you know, launder and hide its money, who favors the United States as a place to get out of paying taxes?
Actually, a lot of people from around the world, they like the United States because it's a very stable place to do business. They come here, they invest in our real estate, and they can do it anonymously. It allows them to hide the money that they're stealing from their own people, so they don't have to pay taxes on it. They don't even have to declare it in their own government. Usually it's a developing or an emerging country. They can stash it here in America. They buy, you know, penthouses in New York City. They buy mansions in Miami Beach, and they can do it anonymously.
And what do you think the access to the Panama Papers is going to mean to people outside the very specialized world of financial investigations and people such as yourself and investigative journalists? What's it going to mean for them to be able to see who's doing these kinds of things?
Well, it's certainly a help. I mean, my problem is not just the illegal work that's going on, illegal money that's being stashed in these tax havens, but it's the legal money that's being stashed in these tax havens. I mean, this is the place of choice for U.S. multinational corporations to put their money offshore. Apple, let's take that as an example, you know, marquee company, brand name company. Apple has $200 billion in profits that are offshore. Almost all of that money is in tax havens. That means it's paying virtually nothing in taxes to the tax haven alone, and it owes almost the full tax here in America, but it's refusing to bring that money back because it's kind of holding us hostage. It's demanding that the U.S. Congress pass legislation that will allow it to bring that money back at a fraction of what they owe. And that's what the debate about corporate tax reform is all about.
Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Take care.
Frank Lenny is Executive Director of Americans for Tax Fairness. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. 350,000 acres, 88,000 people. That's the number of acres burned in the Alberta wildfire and the number of residents in the town of Fort McMurray displaced by that fire. The walls of flames driven by powerful winds rage on, though cooler weather and light showers are helping firefighters in their suppression efforts at the beginning of the week. Joining me now is Dr. John Innes, Dean of the University of British Columbia's Faculty of Forest and Forest Renewal. Dr. Innes says the fire is beyond human capacity to extinguish it. It's just going to have to burn itself out.
What we're seeing are very dry conditions that are persistent across most of the province of Alberta and extending through Saskatchewan and Manitoba to Ontario. We're dealing with a tinderbox situation caused by very, very dry conditions and a lack of snowfall in the winter. It needs very heavy rain to stop it now.
And has this ever happened in the past?
We do get fires this sort of scale in the boreal forest. They've been recorded before, and they've been recorded in Canada, the USA, and in Russia. Alaska has had fires like this, but we've never had a fire that has been so destructive with human property.
And when you say there have been fires before, the historical record shows that these fires are part of the natural cycle of the replacement of vegetation and the restoration of the plains and the prairie. But with humans in the picture, it's a completely different story.
That's correct, because humans are very successful at reducing fires and putting them out. And as a result, we have a buildup of fuel across the landscape, and that's what's now burning.
Who is likely to be displaced here besides the people from Fort McMurray?
Well, we have surrounding communities, and we have a number of Aboriginal communities, and they are the ones that are going to be suffering.
And what does this mean for them returning to their homes? I mean, what does this mean about the safety of that land that's now been shaken? And anyone who's witnessed what's happened here can't possibly think the same way about the lands again.
Well, once the fire has occurred, there's unlikely to be another fire for some time because all the fuel has been burnt. And in Fort McMurray, they put a lot of effort into ensuring that some of the infrastructure does survive. And that's going to make it easier for the people who have houses to come back. The people who've lost houses, that's going to take a lot longer.
And the images from Fort McMurray are so disturbing. I mean, they've even warned residents that they really shouldn't pay attention to them until the recovery effort and the rebuilding effort begins.
Yes, they're absolutely terrifying. And I think one of the first steps the authorities will need to do is try and clear away as much of the debris as possible so that it looks a lot better. That's the policy that was adopted in Australia when there were some very severe fires in Victoria in 2009. One of the first things they did was clear away as much of the burnt debris as possible.
And what about supplies of water and other infrastructure as people begin to move back into this area? Are they degraded in any way?
Yes, it's very likely that much of the infrastructure is degraded. There will be problems with power. There's going to be problems with water. Natural gas and other fuels are going to be a major difficulty, and those will have to be redeveloped.
And can communities in similar circumstances protect themselves from something like this, looking at the Fort McMurray circumstance?
Yes, it is possible to reduce the risk. It's not possible to completely eliminate it, but there are programs that have been quite successful in reducing the fuel in the immediate vicinity of municipalities. And we've seen places like Lillooet in British Columbia, Alexis Creek in British Columbia, where they did treat the forest. And when a fire did occur, it was much less intense, and they were able to control it and stop it entering the community.
John Ennis is Dean of the University of British Columbia's Faculty of Forestry. Thank you so much, Professor.
My pleasure.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, funding research so patients do more than survive, they live their lives. Learn more at lls.org.
Our Community College Challenge series today focuses on a program that finds students with a lot of free time and not a lot to look forward to. We return to Walla Walla Community College in Washington State. At Walla Walla, Miles Johnson finds himself inside the largest employer in town. He's not a worker, though. He's an inmate.
This was not my first time in prison. I've been to prison three previous times, and that didn't work out, obviously. Well, I had a lot of drug problems, and I was stealing cars to support my habits.
Miles is a graduate, though, of Walla Walla's correctional education program at the Washington State Penitentiary. The first thing he learned was the patience to stick with his studies to make a change.
It was kind of daunting at first. College was an opportunity that I found after deciding to change. And it didn't change me, but it helped me change. And that change gave me the ability to work through all of this.
Going to school and prison was the mission of the Takeaway series as we explored how Walla Walla Community College's outreach into Washington State Penitentiary is making a difference for individual inmates and the regional economy. Brent Kalk is Dean of Corrections Education. He says teaching inmates is a challenge, but the benefits are huge.
The correctional program at Walla Walla State Penitentiary has been around for many, many years. It's come to a new level within about the last 10 to 12 years. And this started with an initiative that started out with our legislatures in Olympia, and the idea was called reentry. And the whole concept behind reentry was we need to come up with something more effective than just building more prisons. We need to come up with, let's get the person that's incarcerated through their time sentence structure, but let's have them come out with a way to work, support their family, make their car payment, pay their rent, buy a house. We got to start working toward jobs. And that was the idea behind reentry.
Two separate areas where you can have an excess of electrons on one side and a deficit of electrons on the other side. Okay? And the way that beer can is actually set up,
rather than have a repeat cycle of recidivism that goes and goes and goes, how do we shrink that? How do we turn someone who's been convicted and gone through the court system, how do we turn that person from a tax burden on society to a taxpayer in society doing positive things and not coming back?
Look around at the older people that are there and have been there over and over. That's your retirement option. You can look at the flyers or you can be one of those old guys. I was getting there and I decided I didn't want to be there. It's a lot more mundane. School becomes really exciting when your other option is looking at some walls or a television.
My name's Tony McGuire. I'm the building maintenance technology instructor for Walla Walla Community College at Washington State Penitentiary in Walla Walla, Washington.
And then what happens as you open and close circuits, there's going to be a positive side of the capacitor and a negative side. So
my name is Dwight Penner. I'm a diesel technology instructor at the Washington State Penitentiary for Walla Walla Community College. It is a very challenging environment, but I find that the students here are very anxious to learn and do extremely well in this environment.
And what did we say capacitance was? Storage. That's correct. And what's the symbol for it? Farads. That's correct. And what is one farad?
When we're in class, they are very anxious to learn. They are always attentive, always apply themselves very, very well. There's one or two that have a difficult time and aren't as interested, but the majority of them are very interested. These men out here are far better behaved, in my opinion, than you would see in most school systems.
Well, I learned a little bit about patience. not just in school, but in prison. You know, nothing comes quick or easy. You've got to work for it and wait for it to pay off. And I know it'll pay off. I know I have the intelligence and the knowledge to make better wages. It just takes a minute to find them.
You want programs that have value. So that means that anytime we come up with an idea for a new vocational program, we are checking to see what the employability is, how many openings there are in the state. Is it a living wage job? And can they actually make good money in this through a one-year certificate? Will the people in that trade hire a convicted felon? And so we have to ask a lot of hard questions because you have to have a yes. You have to have a positive answer in all those areas or you just don't do that program.
Having the education, it felt like a boost. You know, it gave me an extra card in my pocket. I could say, you know, I spent 7 years in prison, but I spent 5 years of those 7 years getting education, not just sitting around waiting. I completed an associate's degree, and then I started a HVAC certificate course through Walla Walla Community College. And that is what got me into the union. I just had my interview for apprenticeship on Monday. It's a long process.
That was Miles Johnson, a Walla Walla Community College graduate and proud holder of both an HVAC and graphic design certificate, and Brent Calk, Dean of Corrections Education for Walla Walla Community College. Instructors Dwight Penner and Tony McGuire also spoke. They teach offender students at the Washington State Penitentiary. To find out more about Walla Walla Community College and to hear an extended version of our interviews with Miles Johnson and the other folks, or to find out how the community colleges in your area rank, please visit thetakeaway.org/community college. That little blot on the sun we were talking about earlier this hour asks a question. How is that little planet not falling into the sun? How is the sun's massive energy not obliterating little Mercury? There is a deeper question. How are we able to understand what is happening on Mercury and the sun and theorize about many more things? How can we come close to dominating the resources on Earth, enslaving the planetary systems to human demands, even to the point where we know we've gone too far? How can we hold an apparently unlimited capacity to comprehend the universe and events that stretch back in time billions of years, but find our lifespans limited? Physicist Sean Carroll asked himself some of these questions as a college student while listening to this Emerson, Lake, and Palmer tune a long time ago. His new book takes a real good stab at answering them. Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology, author of The Big Picture on the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, John.
This is a spectacularly ambitious book. Let me just say that right off the top. Do you believe that all of scientific thought, and that's sort of the impression you get from this book, is converging to some sort of unifying understanding of consciousness, the meaning of life, and what the universe is all about?
You know, it's always difficult to predict when things will happen, but I do think that what we have is sort of the background in which those questions are going to be addressed. Yes, I think that, you know, there is one universe. It sort of fits together. We talk about it in different ways. And there are many, many, many questions within that that we don't know the answer to, but they're not going to overthrow the basic picture.
And is this a matter of dotting I's and T's, or is this an exciting moment that we're really on the edge of here as a scientist?
Well, I think it's an exciting moment. We might not be on the edge of it. It's an exciting time that we sort of have put together this basic framework of a natural world that evolves according to certain rules. But who knows how long it will take to actually do this? I would not call it dotting it I's. I would not refer to it that way. It's really like there's a project. We've seen the map. We've started on this journey.
Consciousness is complexity. Why would the Big Bang create the conditions for blobs of complexity called consciousness in places like Earth?
Well, it's a great question. I think it's sort of one of the big questions that we have only just begun to grapple with scientifically. We have this wonderful story of entropy increasing. The entropy of the universe is just the disorderliness of it. And the universe started very low entropy and organized, and it's gradually winding down and becoming more and more disorderly. That makes sense, but then why do complex structures come into being? What we're glimpsing right now is the fact that in order to have complex structures exist, appear, and then sustain themselves, you need that increase of entropy. It's not just that we human beings are permitted by the laws of physics and permitted by the second law of thermodynamics that says the universe is getting more disorderly. It's really that we rely on that just to be here.
And so life and our lifespans, as you describe them, become like an ignition event, that something happens and the circumstances of biology and neuroscience and information science ignite what we call consciousness in our brains and then creates this civilization and we exist for a time and then poof, it goes away, kind of like the sun will eventually burn itself out. So that's why our lifespans are limited?
Yeah, you know, in some cosmic sense, our lifespans are limited because the universe will just wind down
right.
all the way. Now, to be honest, there's a much more immediate reason why our lifespans are limited. Biology did not tune us to try to live all that long. Mammals tend to have around 1.5 billion heartbeats for their lifespans. We humans, because we have good medicine, we get about 3 billion heartbeats on average. And that honestly, that's not that much, right? 3 billion is not such a big number. Although biology, you know, is progressing very, very fast. They could fix that. There's no law of physics that says we couldn't have lifespans measured in the thousands or millions of years.
Does the universe want to create entities that can understand it? Or is consciousness some accident that we happen to be experiencing?
Well, the universe doesn't have wants, we don't think. We don't think that's the appropriate vocabulary to use. It is a natural outcome of the evolution of the universe from the very orderly Big Bang to today that such complex self-referential creatures such as ourselves came into being.
It's so, inevitable? Consciousness is inevitable?
I don't know if it's inevitable, yeah. But it's not really an accident either. It's sort of it's in between. It's the kind of thing that you wouldn't be surprised to see, but it's not inevitable. Well, at least to the current understanding that we have, we don't think it's inevitable.
Is life different than information, or is information a kind of mapping of what we think of life? You know, some people say that we are nothing but information, but, you know, I can cut myself and bleed
yeah.
here.
That's right. I think we're not – it's not accurate to say we're nothing but information. Information is all over physics. So even when life is not involved, information is crucially important. I think that we don't have a great definition of what counts as life or not, but one of the most crucial ingredients is that living things – change over time, right? Something that is absolutely static and unchanging might have information in it, but you wouldn't call it alive. So there's something special about how we evolve through time and respond to the outside world that makes us alive.
You say that quantum states are a key to understanding the ways in which consciousness is both complex but also very organic. And that humans can be both, you know, kind of crazily unpredictable and also ploddingly conformist.
Yeah, well, quantum mechanics is the way the world works. So again, in some trivial sense, everything is due to quantum mechanics. But there's an interesting question about how much the differences between quantum reality and our old-fashioned classical notions of the world are really crucial to understanding life and thinking and so forth. That's another one of these great unanswered open questions that we're just beginning to poke at right now.
Your book, On the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself, the big picture is the original title. The Origins of Life gets fairly close to the Darwin's
That's right.
book. I mean, are scientists generally at Caltech and MIT and in the biological sciences interested in the same things, or are we still in the specialized silos of the late 20th century?
There's a lot of silos, and that's the comfortable place to live. But some of the most exciting and interesting places to live are the bridges between the silos that we're trying to build. You know, I'm a theoretical physicist, but some of my work on entropy and evolution and fluctuations is now rubbing right up against the origin of life and metabolism and the continuance of life through the ecosystem. So the silos that we build are human constructions. Nature is just out there waiting to be talked about.
Was there any sort of assistance to your consciousness when you stumbled on these questions listening to Emerson, Lake, and Palmer?
You never know. Like, as I say very clearly in the book, physics is a great thing to study because it's the simplest science. Physics really takes the universe apart and looks at its simplest, tiniest constituents. When you get to biology, consciousness, the social sciences, oh my goodness, that is so much more complicated. So I wouldn't claim to know what stimulated which part of my brain while I was writing the book.
But you weren't helping it with Annie Greensprings?
I was not helping it, you know, other than coffee. There's really
coffee,
nothing.
That's right. You were a conservative scientist there at Caltech. Well, you can't function at Caltech unless you got all your faculties.
There's a old joke that says that a mathematician is a machine for turning coffee into theorems.
Sean Carroll is a theoretical physicist at the California Institute of Technology, author of The Big Picture on the Origins of Life, Meaning, and the Universe Itself, out on May 10th. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
And here's something to take with you today. Human consciousness is given a second chance to Atopodentatus unicus, an extinct reptile from the Triassic period that thrived 250 million years ago in the era right after an event that wiped out 9 out of 10 marine species, the Permian extinction. Scientists reconstructed the head to show that it's got a face like a vacuum cleaner, a kind of hammer-headed vacuum cleaner face. It thrived because scientists say strange mutations and an explosion of new life forms happened after that extinction. Maybe we can evolve air conditioners in our skin before we become fossils after global warming. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.